Chapter 35. The East Wind.
"Dude," Corrin said as he and Dolorum descended the stairs into the torn-up Midwest Operations Center. "What happened?"
Hilo filled him in.
"Get in line to have your hearts cut out, guys. We're headed to Deep Seven."
"Deep Seven?" Dolorum said. "Wow. Do they have snacks?"
"Where's Cassie?" Corinth asked. "Is she on a rampage?"
Hilo glanced over his shoulder.
"I'm not sure, but she is one wrong word from a rampage, so watch what you say."
Hilo hoped he was listening. Corinth's mouth didn't always consult with his brain before he talked.
Dolorum extended his hand and Hilo shook it.
"Corinth tells me I owe you, Hilo. Why didn't you ever mention you saved Tella? I was there in the audience, you know. When I saw all those dreads, and then the Shed walk out on stage instead of her, I rode all over town searching for her. I thought she was dead, until I saw her arrive back at her hotel with a bunch of ash angels around her."
"It never came up," Hilo said.
Dolorum hugged him.
"Well, I think I understand why I've had two visions with you. Divine karma. The next greasy food joint we hit is on me. Looking forward to it."
The door to the extraction room opened, and Cassandra stepped out. The vulnerable sadness that helped her accept some show of compassion from Magdalene had, with the nearing of dawn, turned into the same anger Hilo remembered from the first days of his training. The bitter eyes and hard, flinty face regarded him for a moment, then turned away.
Corinth stood tall. "Hey, Cassie. Good to—"
She walked by without a glance. The extraction tech stuck his head out.
"Next."
Hilo stepped in, laid back on the table, and raised his shirt. He still couldn't sort his own feelings out. At least he could understand Goldbow's dilemma. Once he had made the mistake of rejoining his family, protecting them afterward was the right thing to do. Did he really love Cassandra? His desperate attempts to get her back seemed sincere. Cassandra probably thought he'd just used her to get close to Trevex and blow up their missions every time they turned around. He doubted they would ever know the truth. Goldbow's fate was anyone's guess. A captured Ash Angel could suffer indefinitely. Their instructors at Trevex told stories of dreads submerging Ash Angels in water up to their necks and subjecting them to all manner of torture, the dawn erasing the wounds so they could start all over again. Through all the cuts and slurping sounds of extraction, Hilo's mind kept turning back to his conversation with Cassandra in the Morse house. They both carried broken hearts. Hanging on to his new life as an Ash Angel helped him. But where would Cassandra go to ease the pain and start over? Could she start over? Every turn in her life and afterlife had led to pain and betrayal, and he feared the only path she had left to run was one of anger and revenge. The path of a dread.
Access denied.
Deep Seven's high-tech door was as unyielding as ever. The welcoming Anna stood stuck in her animation loop, red error text plastered over her midsection. Hilo pulled the zipper of his navy blue jumpsuit up to his neck and banged on the door, resisting the urge to do it with his head. He didn't have long to wait. The door hissed open, two uniformed Michaels with tree trunk biceps waiting for him.
"This way, sir."
Still a criminal. They marched him down the hall and out into the lobby near the central elevator where Corinth, Cassandra, Dolorum, and Magdalene waited. Cassandra looked ready to kill someone, and Dolorum looked like a sheep who'd accidentally gotten left in the lion's cage.
"Why are you still guarding this man?" Magdalene asked.
"Orders from Arcus Ramus," one of them answered.
"Ugh," Corinth said quietly.
"I'm not sure I'll ever get used to that word in front of his name."
Cassandra set her jaw and folded her arms.
"So where are we off to, fellas? Do we all get to have more humiliating playtime with Faust? What does he do when he's not hurling unsupported accusations at blanks?"
"You're going to go to the council chamber, ma'am."
Magdalene's eyebrows shot up.
"Are we facing a tribunal?"
I wouldn't know, ma'am. The Michaels herded them into the elevator and punched the pad, the elevator whirring to life. The council chamber occupied a floor above the reliquarium at the bottom of the complex. When the elevator settled with a click, Hilo gaped at the palatial foyer before him. It was a work of art wrapped in a technological shell, a mixture of functional needs and the grandeur of a throne room. Burnished nickel etched with airy, delicate angels formed high walls softly illuminated by diffuse lights in the glassy floor and domed ceiling. A gilded statue of Michael crushing the neck of a dragon dominated the center of the oval landing area. The serpent's tail encircled the archangel, pushing visitors toward two arched entryways to their left and right. Under better circumstances, Hilo would have liked to examine the detail, but the Michaels hurried them toward the left archway. 10 steps curved downward, flaring at the base, and emptied into a gallery of plum-colored seats gently sloping down toward a dais. Polished white marble, looking almost wet, reflected the even glow of light emanating from the oval dome in the center of the ceiling, concentrating the most illumination on the dais. At the bottom of the slope, a darkly stained walnut divider separated the gallery from 2 rows of dark chairs just before the dais. 2 plum-colored banners were draped from ceiling to floor on either side of the dais, each decorated with a golden halo sword symbol halfway down. The room looked like a mix of court and cathedral. "Sit front and center," one of the Michaels ordered. Cassandra rolled her eyes and plopped down on the back left. Hilo took a seat nearby, still taking in the artwork etched into the metallic walls. On the dais, 2 luxurious seats awaited the Arcus and Diarcus at the center, 3 lesser chairs stretching out to either side. All were empty. On the wall behind them, facing the dais, hung large glassy monitors as thin as a sheet of paper. Dark walnut doors behind the dais suggested rooms beyond.
"There's 1 chair too many," Hilo observed, noting an 8th chair on the dais. "That's for any unascended resident in Deep 7," Magdalene explained. "Rachel would sit there when Gabriel asked her to, though she rarely said much."
A door behind the dais slid open, and Diarchus Joan walked out alone.
"Welcome, and thank you for coming," Joan said. "You two," she ordered, indicating the 2 guards. "You may leave."
"Arcus Ramus indicated we should remain with Hilo until he explicitly ordered otherwise, Madam Diarchus."
"I am explicitly ordering you otherwise."
"Yes, ma'am."
The 2 guards left in a hurry, and Magdalene stood and greeted the Diarchus with a handshake.
"Is this a tribunal?" she asked.
"Not officially, no," Joan answered. "But it's going to feel like one. These are strange times, Maggie. We've never been so off balance. And I don't think we're handling the situation well. We've gotten used to being on top of the dreads, and we're not on top anymore."
The door behind her slid open again, and the entire archive filed out to stand in front of the seats. Magdalene indicated they should stand, and Hilo did. Cassandra took her time. They all waited until Grand Arcus Gabriel took his seat before settling in themselves. They were dressed in the same navy blue jumpsuits as everyone else, though theirs were trimmed with gold, each bearing their angel name and patch of office. Hilo recognized all the faces now. It was evident gravity hung heavily on them. Silence fell while everyone waited on Grand Arcus Gabriel, who consulted a tablet in his hand. Cassandra bent forward in her seat, head in her hands.
"Where's the guard I ordered for Hilo?" Arcus Ramus stuck in during the silence. "I ordered them off," Joan informed him. "I'm not sure why you see the necessity for it. What danger does he pose? We know who the traitor was."
"I beg your pardon, Diarchus," Ramus apologized. "I should explain myself. It is because of his connection to this dread Dahlia. I fear he is being manipulated. Tell us, Hilo, have you been in contact with her again?"
Hilo recounted his encounter with her at the Redemption Motorcycle Club, every eye on the dais drilling into him as if trying to bore into his soul and pull out the truth. He left out the part where Dahlia had begged for death after she had been defeated.
"And you can confirm this?"
Ramus asked Dolorum.
Yes. Though I couldn't hear the entire conversation from the back room where I was bent like a pretzel. She used at least 3 bestowals on me.
Impossible! Arcus Ebenezer screeched. These 2 are not credible.
Why not? Gabriel said.
An old master and a trainee with a questionable record? Ebenezer argued.
Ebenezer said old master with a heap of disdain.
Dolorum sat back and folded his arms.
Are you saying they are liars or that they have been tricked somehow? Diarchus Joan asked.
Ebenezer held up his hands.
All I'm saying is that something else is at work here. None of you has asked Hilo the obvious question. Here we have an Ash Angel who manages to defeat a dread woman who is a Vexus receptacle, Vexus drained from an atrocity site he was personally connected with. He has the time and the means to finish her off, and yet he decides to leave her there. It was his duty to end her. Any other Ash Angel would have done it. If he was not under her influence, why would he let her live?
Which, Ramus popped in, is exactly why I have ordered him under guard. This close, personal contact with the Dread may influence him to undermine our operations.
Gabriel turned to Hilo.
Their question is valid. Why not end her life?
Because Rachel the Unascended told me that I should believe her, and that one day Dahlia would save my life.
How dare you perpetrate such a slander on an unascended, Arcus Ebenezer said, rising from his seat with fervor. No unascended would condone a course of action that allowed those animals and their darkness to persist.
They aren't animals, Arcus Simeon said. Some have turned.
Not enough to matter, Simeon. Get off your bleeding heart dread-saving platform. We must kill the dreads as fast as we can. I'm sure Arcus Mars agrees with me. Ebenezer said.
The only time we should let them live is when there is a tactical advantage to doing so, Mars clarified.
Ebenezer sat back down.
There wasn't one in this case.
Diarchus Joan turned on him.
Hilo believes she will save his life. That would be a tactical advantage for him at least.
Ebenezer snorted.
You don't honestly believe an unascended would condone letting a dread live?
I think it would be foolish to assume you can say what an unascended would or wouldn't do,
Diarchus Joan retorted.
Rachel was a pacifist in life and in the afterlife. The unascended have as many different opinions among them as we sitting in this room do. Their lack of ascension doesn't suddenly bless them with more divine insight. Long study does, and Rachel studied those books in the reliquarium more than anyone here. Calling Hilo a liar is uncalled for and disrespectful.
Ebenezer opened his mouth, but Gideon raised a hand to end the discussion.
Arcus Lux, have any of your visionaries or cryptics had any visions of Hilo, Dahlia, Devon Quinn, or Goldbo that might aid us right now?
Lux, who'd largely avoided the arguments that seemed so common among the others, sat forward in her chair. She was slender, with nearly white hair, and a thin, pale face, her features and large eyes giving her a fairy-like appearance.
I reviewed the latest visions and dreams before I came, and there was nothing in them that would aid us, she reported.
Rachel saw Dahlia and me, Hilo offered. She saw the tattoos on Dahlia's arm that I saw when she absorbed the Vexus at the crash site.
Oh, Ebenezer mocked. And I suppose we'll just have to take your word for that, too?
She drew pictures of us and the symbols. They were down in the reliquarium. I asked Cassandra to let the Scholis know before I was forced out.
I told Ebenezer, Cassandra said. I messaged him before I left.
Did you look into it, Ebenezer? Gideon asked.
I get a lot of messages, and we've been too busy to go chasing idle tales.
This tale is appearing less idle by the minute, Gabriel said. Voice disapproving. Control, please contact Naomi in the reliquarium.
A few moments passed, and Naomi's voice flooded the room.
This is Naomi.
This is Gideon. Have Rachel's effects been removed from the reliquarium?
No, Grand Arcus.
Do you have a mobile camera there?
On my phone, yes.
Rachel had
A desk in the back of the library. Will you give us a live feed of what is there?
Sure. 1 minute.
Thank you, Arcus Gideon said. Primus, establish a live link with Naomi's camera in the reliquarium and project the image on screen 3.
Link established, Primus said.
Those facing the dais craned their necks around as Naomi's shaky cam provided them a view of the reliquarium door sliding open. Once they got to the desk, Gideon asked her to show them the sketches on the walls.
That's me, and that's Dahlia, Hilo narrated. And those are the 3 symbols I saw on Dahlia's arm. Rachel told me she saw the 2 of us in her head, me for years. Said others had too.
Do you recognize those symbols, Arcus Ebenezer? Gideon asked.
Ebenezer cleared his throat, looking a little sheepish.
Well, one is familiar from the writings of Micah, the medieval researcher considered the father of the Scholus. He claimed one of the dreads he was torturing drew that symbol. It was the beginning of Micah's fruitless hunt for the fabled dread lore masters that got him nothing but thrown into a well.
What's the symbol mean?
We aren't sure, but having the other 2 might help, he conjectured. However, I don't think we have time for this line of research right now. We need to keep our resources focused on Devon Quinn. He's bringing in some new weapons and equipment, and we have to find out how. Not to mention he's probably using the Vexes from the air disaster for some dark purpose. My guess is shed creation.
I agree, Gideon said. But this is all tied together somehow. We've never understood how Shedim were created from the Vexes of atrocity sites, but we've just got our first clue. Since Hilo saw these symbols on Dahlia after she was healed by the arrival of Dusk, that means they are not temporary. And if they collected the Vexes from 4 atrocity sites, they are clearly up to some plan that probably ties in with the new threats we are seeing. Ebenezer, you assign a team to go down to that reliquarium and see what else Rachel had down there and figure out what those symbols mean. At the very least, this exculpates Hilo from any suspicion. As an unascendant, Rachel was a visionary, and I won't have him reprimanded for following her advice.
Ebenezer nodded and turned to his data pad. The room settled, and Gideon leaned back in his chair.
Let's turn to Goldbow. Magdalene, could you and Ramus narrate how this leak was exposed and the basics of the operation to extract Goldbow's family from their residence, please?
Magdalene and Arcus Ramus told the story. Cassandra scowled at the wall. Hilo could tell her friends were trying to protect her as much as possible. Arcus Ebenezer wouldn't let that happen. Goldbow led a group of possessed, and now dead ones, I might add, to the Midwest Operations Center. It is forever and expensively compromised. And why call Hilo to investigate? Cassandra should have contacted you, Ramus. If she would have done her duty and called this in, it wouldn't have happened, and lives, normal lives, would have been saved.
Arcus Ramus turned on the man who had been his ally for most of the proceeding.
Arcus Ebenezer, with all due respect, you and the Scholus have no idea of the emotional rigors of being a Gabriel agent in the field, and you certainly know nothing of Cassandra's personal history that might help you view this event with a little more compassion.
Well, why don't you enlighten us, Ramus, if you're in the know? Ebenezer spat back.
All you need to know is that Cassandra and Goldbow were involved romantically while Goldbow was still involved with his wife and family, and if you can't understand what that would do to a woman, then maybe you really have forgotten what it is to be human. Cassandra is my agent and I will deal with this issue. She was the one instrumental in discovering Goldbow's treachery and you should be thanking her.
Hilo raised his eyebrows.
Ramus's fiery defense had caught Ebenezer off guard, and Ebenezer wasn't the only one with wide eyes. Silence reigned for several moments before Gideon stepped in.
The long-reaching effects of Goldbow's actions will take some time to unravel. But whatever he's done, he's paying for it now. I will leave the matter of Cassandra's discipline to Arcus Ramus. Did Goldbow's interrogation reveal anything, Mars?
He was the source for the Blank Massacre, Mars reported, and the failure of many missions besides. He confessed to providing them with a technical layout of Trevex.
He claims the communication protocols and encryption keys are intact. He said he wouldn't know how to compromise those if he wanted to. I want to say in his behalf that he regrets what he's done, but he couldn't let his wife and boys be slaughtered.
Did he have a dread handler? Gideon asked.
Yes, two. A man at first, and a woman lately. They never used names. I think we can rest easy now.
Ramus scrunched his eyebrows.
Rest easy? You seem to forget what Devin Quinn was doing to Hilo in that bathroom. Devin has a system for breaking down Ash Angels and finding out who their past relations were so he can blackmail them for information. We thought the problem was bad when only blanks were suspects. Now anyone could be. We've learned that protecting humans by betraying Ash Angels does not turn an Ash Angel into a dread. This changes the game forever.
So you believe Hilo now? Simeon asked.
Ebenezer stepped in.
We believe most of the particulars. We still doubt Devin has some sort of controlling device for the dreads, and that Dahlia is somehow Aklima, which would make her a 6,000-year-old dread. We should focus on this Devin Quinn. He's the threat right now.
What do we know about him? Gideon asked.
Well, he founded Quinn Maritime over 20 years ago, mostly from buying smaller companies and gobbling up their assets. He appointed a Merrick Evenich as the CEO 5 years later, and really hasn't been involved much in the company since then. Devin, we believe, has been instrumental in using cash from his investments to start up the dummy corporations he uses to move money around and do whatever manufacturing he's been working on. He has staggering wealth all stashed away securely in banks and funds all over the world. His involvement in Quinn Maritime makes him an absolute nightmare. He can get things to and from anywhere in the world. He's got cargo ships and container ships of all types and varieties at his disposal. Add his wealth and his dread support, and we've got a serious problem.
Do we know where we can hit him? Mars asked. Where are they making these new weapons?
We don't know, Ebenezer admitted. We're working on it.
I've developed a 3-pronged strategy, Ramus suggested suddenly.
First, we need to complicate his corporate operations by tipping off federal investigators to the dummy corporations. Second, we need to cut off the head of the snake with a standing kill order on Devin. We find him, we take him down. Third, we need more intelligence, and that means we need to ramp up dread interrogations. Before we proceed with details, however, I would like the room cleared. I believe we've had enough testimony to get our bearings on the events that have transpired so that we can move forward.
Agreed, Ebenezer said.
Hilo couldn't help but think the man was just happy to be rid of them. Hilo was torn between wanting to go and wanting to find out more.
Very well, Gideon said.
What are we supposed to do? Hilo asked.
You're all to be reassigned, Ramus said. What form that will take is still uncertain. You'll be with us on Deep 7 for a few days until we get everything sorted out. You are dismissed.
Everyone stood, Dolorum exhaling to express his annoyance. Cassandra took off like a shot. Just before Hilo reached the stairs that led to the elevator, a sudden thought struck him. Something about Tella's song that had run through his mind nearly constantly since the air disaster.
Excuse me, Arcus Ebenezer, Hilo said, returning and approaching the dais.
Can I ask if one of the ships under the control of Quinn Maritime is named the East Wind?
I don't know, he answered with some irritation. Why?
Just a hunch.
We don't have time to play hunches, Hilo. Dismissed.
Hilo returned to his companions, and the five of them crammed into the elevator, heading back up.
You know, Corinth said, I thought seeing the Archive would be, I don't know, more awesome or holy or dignified or something. They seem to fight as much as the rest of us.
Magdalene smiled.
Not as much, Corinth. More. That was a tame meeting by most standards. I think they tried to keep it under control to make sure we felt confident that they had things well in hand. I can read Gideon like a book. He's scared. They're all scared. Try not to take anything they do to us in the next few days too seriously. I think they're fishing.
Yeah, Corinth said.
I hate to say it, but it seemed like Arcus Ramus was the only one who had a plan.
Ramus has a plan for putting on his socks, Cassandra added.
That's just Ramus. He's had so many three-pronged plans, they should change his name to Trident.
Corinth laughed.
Nice one, Cassie. Getting that sense of humor back?
She belted him in the face with her elbow, rocking his head backwards so that it hit the shiny elevator wall.
Now that's funny.
The elevator doors opened. The two guards that had shadowed him earlier waiting with their hands behind their backs. They moved aside as everyone disembarked. One Michael put his fingers on his earpiece. His hand shot out, clamping around Hilo's arm. The Archai has requested your presence.
I was just there 20 seconds ago.
They responded by pulling him onto the elevator with them and punching up the council chamber. The last thing Hilo saw as the doors shut was Magdalene's surprised, curious look. When he arrived back in the council chamber, the chatter of the Archai filled the room, all of them intent on the screens in front of them.
Mute screens, Ramus said as Hilo approached the dais.
That's not necessary, Diarchus Joan contradicted.
Agreed,
Grandarchus Gabriel joined in. Hilo peeked behind him, finding all three screens lit up, one with a map, one with a picture of a cargo ship, and the last with some sort of documentation.
Well, Hilo,
Joan said, casting a sideways glance at Ebenezer.
It is lucky I had time to play your hunch. It took all of 10 seconds to find out that yes, Quinn Maritime does have a ship called the East Wind, that yes, it is bound for Chicago, and that yes, it is due to land in about 36 hours. It came out of the port of Vladivostok, a well-known hub for the shipping of vehicles and metal products, which, as it turns out, the East Wind is carrying. So what we want to know is how you came up with the name. Did Dahlia tell it to you?
No, Hilo replied. Do you know who Telamirin is?
I don't.
Hilo explained her origins and her gift. Her words and imagery are like the visions of cryptics. But if you look at the lyrics of her last two songs, you will see that the troubles with Goldbow were described in a roundabout way, and this last one she sang has something to do with what's going on now. After some searching, they pulled up the video of Tella's TV performance and watched it with rapt attention, Arcus Lux and Ebenezer typing notes on their tablets.
There are clear references to weapon sanctification, Arcus Lux offered after the video closed. Goldbow might be the one alluded to in the first two stanzas.
Arcus Ebenezer stood and started pacing.
And if we conclude that the East Wind is actually this ship, we must consider that it is carrying cargo that will bring some sort of metaphorical tempest. Shadim are associated with elements, so it's possible the Vex's collection that's been witnessed is to create a shed with power over water or air or both. A powerful one.
Who is the flesh and heart singing? Diarchus Joan asked.
Tell us the one who sang this, Ebenezer suggested.
No, Hilo said loudly.
They all looked at him.
Sorry, but the flesh and heart are of the angel of the first two stanzas. I've thought a lot about this song over the last few days. I never connected Goldbow to the angel until Arcus Lux mentioned it. This whole song is about a boat being blown in. Goldbow was a seal. He knows ships and storms and the sea. Maybe it means he will warn us somehow.
What kind of boat is that? Gideon asked, referring to a picture of the enormous East Wind.
It's registered as a roll-on, roll-off, Ramus answered. They carry vehicles. The boat is designed with multiple decks. The vehicles can be driven on and driven off, so there is no need for cranes or lifts to load and unload. They could, if they were clever, hide weapons in the cars.
We need eyes on that ship now, Gideon ordered. How do we do it?
While the Archai started bandying about options, Lux's eyes seemed pegged to her tablet, her face growing steadily more alarmed until she stood from her chair.
Arcus Ramus, Arcus Mars, she said over the din. You're going to want to see this.
The room went silent.
What is it, Lux? Gideon asked.
We've received more than 25 visions and dreams in the last half hour. Multiple events. Now it's 26.
Are they centered in Chicago? Joan asked. We've only got locations for 14 of them so far, and no.
Then where?
Arcus Lux tapped the pad, and 14 blinking red dots showed up on the map on one of the big screens.
Everywhere.
Do we know when?
Initial analysis suggests in the next 48 hours.
Gideon leaned forward in his chair to better view Lux. What kind of action do the visions and dreams suggest? Lux swallowed.
Death. On a large scale. Schools. Malls. Theaters.
Everyone studied the map on the wall, Lux adding two more locations as they came into her tablet.
The strategy is simple but effective, Arcus Mar said, stubby hands crossed in front of him.
They're spreading out, Hilo explained for him, finally turning his gaze on Gideon.
They're going to make us choose between raiding the East Wind and saving normals.